Today we are in Genesis chapter 20 and 21. Chapter 20 is about Abraham and Abimelech. After the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that we talked about last week, Abraham, still the wanderer that he was, he leaves the open hill country of Judah and he goes to the Canaanite state of Gerar, which was on the coastal plain. Chapter 20 contrasts Abraham's behavior in Gerar with his behavior in Egypt back in chapter 12. You'll remember that. In chapter 12, if you remember, Abraham went to Egypt because of the famine in his land, and then he told Sarah to tell everyone that she was his sister. Because she was so beautiful, he was afraid that she may be taken as someone's wife. Well, Pharaoh did just that back in chapter 12. He wanted to take Sarah as his wife, and she ended up in his harem. In this chapter 20, nothing is being said that might draw attention either to Abraham's cowardice, as he had back in chapter 12, or to Sarah's beauty, both of which were highlighted in chapter 12. But Abraham had never been able to conquer a deep-rooted fear that his beautiful wife would catch somebody's eye, and they would get rid of him in order to have her. So by giving in to that temptation again, now in this new place he's in, Abraham risked turning what was in the past a sinful act into a sinful pattern of lying whenever he suspected that his life was in danger. He had not been afraid to launch out in faith from Ur when God first called on him to leave Ur and go someplace where he had no idea God was going to take him. He wasn't afraid then. He had been anything but fearful at all when he chased the kings. Remember the five kings who had captured Lot? And he chased them for a great, great distance so that he could rescue Lot? He wasn't fearful then. He had even been bold enough to challenge God in his own intercession for Sodom when he kept pleading with God for God to spare the city because of a certain number of righteous people. But when it came to his own fears concerning his wife, his Achilles heel continued to be exposed. Sadly, he had not recognized this weakness, and as a result, he had not dealt properly with it. Well, sometimes the same is true for us. I mean, no matter how much we love God, certain temptations are especially difficult to resist. These are what we call the vulnerable spots in our spiritual armor. I mean, we might wonder how Abraham could so easily fall into this sin after he'd seen all that God had done for him. Well, there are three spiritual considerations that affected Abraham, and they can affect us also. I just want to take a brief look at those. The first spiritual consideration is what we call spiritual exhaustion. It's not uncommon to find spiritual exhaustion following some real spiritual high point we just had, that we just experienced. An anticlimax can come swiftly on the heels of a spiritual climax. After his remarkable experience of prayer and victory in the Sodom affair, Abraham promptly lapsed into old patterns of behavior, which were strangely incompatible with what had just taken place for such a brave, bold man. Well, Elijah had a similar experience, if you'll remember, after he had that confrontation on Mount Carmel with the priests of Baal. And the wonderful things that happened to him there and the miracle he saw God work through him. Many believers have learned to be on their guard against a spiritual letdown in their own lives. Remember Elijah, after that wonderful thing he did, because Jezebel had threatened him and said she was going to kill him, he ran far away and he was hiding in a cave. Spiritual letdowns in our lives are not really uncommon. The second spiritual consideration is what we call spiritual amnesia, and it allowed Abraham to forget about the promises of God, particularly as they relate to his wife's role in the divine plan for the nations. Remember, Sarah was going to birth a son because Abraham had been promised that he would be the father of many nations. Well, the son had to be born before that could happen. If Sarah had disappeared into the lives of the Philistines, if she had stayed in Pharaoh's harem and become, you know, his bride, what would have become of the promised son for whom they had waited so long, so many years? See, under pressure, it's not unusual for spiritual forgetfulness to take over. How many times in our lives, you know, God's made promises to us that have yet to be fulfilled. And then when something comes along that threatens that promise or threatens our life, we forget the promise of God. It hasn't happened yet, so, you know, the enemy can't take us out yet. We haven't fulfilled the promise that God spoke to us. But sometimes we forget the promises he's made us. And the third spiritual consideration is what we call spiritual myopia. Abraham's short-sightedness here is really interesting. I mean, remember how he had been so concerned that God should deal justly with Sodom and its inhabitants? He just worried so much about them being destroyed. Well, he now appeared to be totally unaware that he himself was showing no concern whatsoever for the inhabitants of Gerar in general, and their king Abimelech in particular. Abraham's vision was filled with his own concerns. His perspective was warped to the shape of his own paranoia. King Abimelech is immediately warned by God in a dream who Sarah really is. And his plea of innocence is accepted first by God and then by Abraham. So God somehow prevented Abimelech from sinning. Think about that. What mercy on God's part that he prevented him from sinning. He, you know, revealed to him in the dream about Sarah. And also a side note here. Verse 17 is the very first time in the Bible where the word prophet is mentioned. Let me read verse 17. Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girls, so that they could have children again. For the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife Sarah. So God is now revealing how Abraham, being a prophet, can come into the counsel of God to receive his secret counsel to bring life to Abimelech. Okay? Abimelech took Sarah into his household, into his harem. And when that happened, all of the women in Abimelech, King Abimelech's region were no longer able to have children. They were barren. The curse was on them for that. How many times has God done the same for us, holding us back from sin, maybe in ways we don't even detect yet, but he has held us back from sinning in a particular way. In contrasting this with Abraham's first lie in chapter 12 when he lied to Pharaoh about Sarah being his sister, well, God didn't warn Pharaoh. Pharaoh guessed the truth on his own, and then he confronted Abraham with it before expelling him from Egypt in no uncertain manner. But remember now, back in Egypt, Abraham made no reply to Pharaoh when the accusation came. When Pharaoh said, "Why have you done this to me? Why did you tell me this lie about your wife being your sister?" Abraham made no reply. But here, in Gerar, he launches into a lengthy justification of his deception, which he claims had more to do with there being no fear of God at all in this place than with any fearfulness on his part. See, he's making excuses. He also stresses that Sarah was not only his wife, but also his half-sister. That was true. She was. They both had the same father, but different mothers. So she was his half-sister. But this doesn't exempt Abraham from criticism, but it does hint at his regretting his strategy almost at once. This time he made a clean breast of things when he was confronted by Abimelech. Why did you tell this lie? Okay? He makes a clean breast of it and graciously starts to intercede for the man that he had wronged. Let's look at chapter 20 and read verses 14 through 17. Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, "My land is before you. Live wherever you like." To Sarah he said, "I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. This is to cover the offense against you before all who are with you. You are completely vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girls, so they could have children again. For the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah. So why did God punish Abimelech when he had no idea that Sarah was married? I mean, didn't that seem a little unfair? Well, first, even though Abimelech's intentions were good, as long as Sarah was living in his harem, he was in danger of sinning. God was setting up what we would call an intervention. Secondly, the punishment of closing up the wounds in his household would last only as long as Abimelech was in danger of sleeping with Sarah. It was meant to change the situation, not to harm Abimelech. God wanted to change the situation before things went farther and sin would enter in. And third, the punishment clearly showed that Abraham was in league with Almighty God. It may have made Abimelech respect and fear Abraham's God. Abimelech, far from driving Abraham out as Pharaoh had done in chapter 12, instead, Abimelech allows him to settle where he likes in his kingdom. And Abraham prays to God to remove the curse of barrenness which he had brought on Abimelech's wife and concubines. And then in verse 16, it even says, Abimelech gave 1,000 shekels of silver to cover any offense against Sarah. That was about 25 pounds of silver. That's a lot of money back then. Don't forget, this is 2,200 and something B.C. 25 pounds of silver was a fortune. Well, after that, for once, relations between God's people and their pagan neighbors are friendly and peaceable. So now, we move on to chapter 21, which is the fulfillment of two of the seven promises. If you remember, also back in chapter 12, was when God made the first covenant with Abraham, and he made the seven promises to him. And two of those seven promises are being fulfilled here in chapter 21. Chapter 21 opens with laughter, but very quickly it moves on to tears. Let's read verses 1 through 7. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, and he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. And when his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him, as God had commanded. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. Well, after many dramatic events, delays, and roller coaster experiences, the Lord did visit Sarah. Isaac was born, and once again the Lord had proved himself faithful to his word. And then in verse 8 we're told, the child grew and was weaned, and on that day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. Well, you kind of wonder, why would they have a big feast on that? You have to understand that this was a common custom. The pleasure over any child was especially prominent at a weaning celebration in the ancient East. Now, we know from writings from the Second Maccabees that were, you know, discovered in the archaeological arenas, that it was normal for a mother to nurse her child until the age of 3 years old. So we know that because of that custom in this particular place at that time, that Isaac was 3 years old when this big weaning celebration took place. But then let's look at verses 9 and 10. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham was mocking. And she said to Abraham, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." Now the word mocking here in the original text in the Hebrew, that word means to laugh or to make sport of. So Ishmael, remember, Abraham's firstborn son through the concubine, Ishmael is 14 or 15 years old by now. Was it possible that Ishmael was just being a typical nasty big brother engaging in adolescent misbehavior? You know, teasing, like they all do at that age? Maybe. But we do know that Sarah told Abraham, they must go. Okay? Abraham is very distressed about this. So he should be. But it was also not normal, nor was it legal, to reject concubines and their offspring in this way at all. Plus, Abraham must have had a great love for his son. He had been with him 14 or 15 years already, just that, you know, he was the only child. He had to have loved him very much. So now God intervenes and he tells Abraham that this was exactly what he must do. In verse 14, early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water, and he gave them to Hagar, the concubine, and he set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. And she went on her way, and she wandered in the desert of Beersheba. Abraham could not give Ishmael any of the inheritance. That's why it's so detailed here that Abraham only gave her some bread and some water and sent her on her way. It sounds very cruel. I would think it's very cruel. But you see, he couldn't give her anything to take with her for her son, because he couldn't give Ishmael any of the inheritance. The promise from God was that Isaac would be the inheritance, the one for all of the inheritance to come to. And that promise would work itself out through Isaac alone and no one else. And though Ishmael, as his son, would have a great future, as of this moment, he had to be excluded. So does God seem prejudiced here? Could be. We would think so, maybe. We call it prejudice. God calls it grace. The workings of God's grace are not only marvelous, but they can be very perturbing, sometimes quite beyond our ability to understand. Like Abraham, well, sometimes we must simply accept them. Those singled out for God's favor are not singled out for their own sakes, but for the sake of the rest of mankind. God shows favor on individuals so that those individuals can be a tool of favor extended other places in his kingdom to other people. Well, Abraham could only obey, but his heart must have really been breaking the next morning as he gave that bread and water to Hagar and sent her and Ishmael out into the desert. So let's see what happens in verses 15 through 17. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bow shot away, for she thought, "I cannot watch the boy die." And as she sat there nearby, she began to sob. And God heard the boy crying. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there." Okay, remember I said in the beginning, this chapter started out with laughter but ends in tears. Well, here come the tears. Remember, Abraham, back in verse 11, is mourning for his loss. Deeply grieved that his son Ishmael had to be sent away. Hagar is mourning for, she's mourning her impending death and bereavement. And Ishmael is crying out in anguish. Now these combine to present a picture of our world, which knows so much about the time to mourn, yet so often has few resources to meet tragedy when it comes. They need an experience like Hagar's that happened in verse 19. In verse 19, we're told, "Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink." God opened her eyes. Also, if we back up a little bit, remember in verse 17, God heard the boy crying. Well, isn't he a little old to begin crying if he's 14 or 15, to just suddenly start crying because he's afraid? I don't think so. Boys weren't pansies back then. Is it possible that he was crying out to the Lord God? Because think about it. He's 14 or 15. If he was raised in Abraham's household all those years, he must have learned about Jehovah God, whom his father worshipped. It would have made sense that he would cry out to the one that he was taught protected him. So the Lord intervenes and answers Hagar. In verse 18, he says to her, "Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation." So here, God comforts and he encourages and he instructs Hagar. With God watching over Ishmael, he eventually grows up in the desert and he becomes an expert bowman, and his mother procures a wife for him from her own home country of Egypt. And so, fulfillment of promise number 7 from the covenant back in chapter 12 that God made Abraham. Number 7 was, "All peoples will be blessed through you." You see, it's a foretaste of the purchase of land in chapter 23 that we haven't gotten to yet, where Sarah was later buried. But all peoples would be blessed. So when Ishmael was sent away, he became a father of nations, because Ishmael is the stream through which the Arab population came. Isaac was where the Jewish population came, and Ishmael was the Arabs. So they were both used, both sons were used to father great nations. The Ishmaelites became nomads living in the desert of Sinai, south of Israel. One of Ishmael's daughters even married Esau, and you'll see that as we go into further chapters. Verses 22 through 34, those deal with the well at Beersheba. Beersheba was the southernmost city in Israel, right on the edge. Right on the edge of the desert. And because the Negev was an arid region, the wells of Beersheba were really of great importance to man and animal. So it's not surprising that something of a boundary dispute should break out from time to time. Now, when we were in Israel, I can tell you, the whole southern region, which is called the Negev, where Beersheba is really barren. You don't really want to live there. It is barren desert. So water is of the highest importance. Well, here's what happened then. Between Abraham and Abimelech, because remember, Abimelech allowed Abraham to live in all of the territory there also, in peace. They lived together. But Abimelech shows up with his military commander, which was really for a show of strength, because there was a dispute over the wells. The servants were fighting over one of the wells. So, in chapter 21, let's look at verses 22 through 31. It says, at that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his forces, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you do. Now swear to me here before God that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants. Show to me and the country where you are living as an alien the same kindness I have shown to you. Abraham said, I swear it. Then Abraham complained to Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized. But Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this. You did not tell me, and I heard about it only today. So Abraham brought sheep and cattle, and he gave them to Abimelech. And the two men made a treaty. Abraham set apart 7 ewe lambs from the flock, and Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs you have set apart by themselves? And he replied, accept these 7 lambs from my hand as a witness that I dug this well. So that place was called Beersheba, because the two men swore an oath there. It's interesting to see here that Abimelech and Abraham confronting each other with their complaints. Okay, one-on-one, face-to-face. They didn't run around like we do so many times today, unfortunately, even as Christians, when we have a dispute with someone or we're upset with them for something, and instead of going to them first, face-to-face, we go to other people, and we gossip about it, and we have to tell everybody else what that person did to us. But they didn't do that. They confronted each other with the complaints. They both listened respectfully to what the other had to say. Okay, answers were given, and a formal covenant agreement was drawn up. A great model of conflict resolution for us today, wouldn't you say this is? This is exactly the plan that God has for us. Conflict resolution. Well, Abraham offered and Abimelech accepted the 7 ewe lambs as a token of their agreement. Now remember that 7B is an appropriate number here because the well was named Beersheba. In Hebrew, in the original text, the be the word, the first syllable, bear, means well. And sheva means both the number seven, and it means an oath. So, there was an oath made at this well, and seven new lambs were made to seal the agreement. Beersheba was to become an important city on Judah's southern frontier later on, also an important sanctuary and place of pilgrimage, probably because of Abraham's connection with it. So now in verse 33, we're told, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there he called upon the name of the Lord, the eternal God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines for a long time. So what Abraham is doing here, he performs an act of worship. He plants the tamarisk tree, which also symbolized long duration. A tamarisk tree was a tree of great long duration, and that's what it symbolized. And meaning that the treaty was meant to be valid indefinitely. That's what Abraham's saying to him. This treaty has no end. It's valid indefinitely. And then there, Abraham called upon the name of the everlasting God, which in the original text he called upon the name of El Olam. El Olam in Hebrew means everlasting God. I want to encourage you to learn the many different names of God so that you too can use them as part of your worship or as part of your prayer. It's so powerful, and it's a wonderful way to just worship God by, you know, just giving him his due by proclaiming his various names and thinking about what each of those names mean and how we can use them in times where we have a need and one of his particular names meets that need. When your need is, you know, for healing, is you're sick or something's wrong, you need a healing, then you want to call upon Jehovah Rapha, which means God, our healer. You know, you want, if you're really anxious and you have great anxiety and you just have no peace, then you call upon Jehovah Shalom, the God of peace. Using those names are important because it helps to remind us of who God is, who he is, and sometimes we need that reminder. So I just want to close tonight with this brief little worship as we say, El Olam, the eternal God, the God who has no beginning and no end, the God for whom a day is like a thousand years, and a thousand years is like a day. You are the everlasting God, and we thank you, O God. We thank you for your everlasting love, your everlasting mercy, your everlasting grace, eternally given to all who call upon you and your mighty name, El Olam. Okay, and next week we will do chapter 23 and 24.